Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
They've got this mansion there that's, you know, been rocketed and bombed out. The whole village is like pretty much rubble.
Yeah.
And security is pretty loose up there. That's where they're going to be like dealing with a lot of the ISIS conflicts. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Like, I'm not scared. I don't mind a bit of risk.
Sure.
Yeah.
What if the writer is attempting to create a story where nothing much happens, where people don't change? More reflection of the real world.
Nothing happens in the world? Are you out of your fucking mind?
Welcome to A Theory of Mind, a podcast about brains, minds, and the lived-in experience of change. I'm your host, author and biographer Ben McKelvey, and before we get into this week's Anzac Day guest, I just wanted to say that the show and I are taking a little break so I can do a little work on a new book that I've started. I'm not sure how long this break will be. It may be a few weeks, it may be a few months, but I just wanted you to know that the show will be coming back with new guests and maybe even a new format, so we'll see. Anyway, to this week's guest, Sweebs. That's it, Sweebs. He just wanted to be identified as Sweebs. Sweebs is a military veteran who was part of the Australian Special Forces conducting tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. While there's a lot of conversation these days about Afghanistan, Sweebs and I primarily talk about Iraq, and specifically we talk about the Battle of Mosul, which was an epic undertaking that I wrote a book about last year. Sweebs wasn't a source in the book, and he wasn't even really someone I'd met before, so everything that we get into cold. It took a little while to warm up this conversation, but once we get going, I found it so fascinating. He's such an interesting bloke and he's got a great story. Anyway, I appreciate you taking some time to listen to Sweebs and I. If you're listening to this on Anzac Day, I hope you're commemorating and remembering in the way that you see fit. And now, Sweebs.
So yeah, we've only met once before, so if you can give us a little potted history of yourself, of Mick, as we're calling you, that'd be great, and how you got to the military.
Yeah, g'day, Ben. So I was a bit about myself. I was born in New Zealand, a little town just above Auckland, and lived there. I did primary school there, came over to Brizzy and continued school until I was 19, and then actually wasn't a very like academic sort of person. My grades were very average. I think that was a lot of due to like structure and kind of direction, like a lot of people. And then decided that a life of adventure really suited me, and like joined the army at the time was like a good option.
Was there anyone in your family that had been in the military?
Actually, yeah, my granddad. My granddad was in the military, and he went over to – he was part of like – well, he joined the Australian Army.
Oh, yeah.
Even though I'm from New Zealand, we kind of like chased back the roots back to Australia. But my granddad was in the Australian Army, fought in World War One, and also he's actually in a book himself kind of detailing one of the battles that he was in.
Yeah.
End of the day, he was shot in the head after trying to save a couple of his friends. And after getting shot in the head, he was still able to get up and carry one of the guys that he was fighting beside back to the fort, and got sent back to Australia because of his injuries. But yeah, he did something pretty like brave and heroic, in my opinion.
Was this something that was sticking in your head as a kid? This is a point of adventure. You know, you're sort of slugging through school, things are a bit of a chore, but you're like, you know, there is this possibility.
Yeah, subconsciously there was something like that I felt like I could live up to. And
you had a relationship with him? Good relationship?
No, I've never met
him at all.
Nope. It was just my dad that kind of described who he was, and obviously stories and tales like that generate a fair bit of pride and respect.
Yeah, and then you joined the military. Which was the unit that you went to initially?
So after I joined the Army and did Kapooka, I went up to Townsville. Served at 3CR for about 7 to 8 years, where I made a lot of like some of my closest friends up there because we're all at a young age when we first joined the military, and that was the biggest thing that we had in common. Leaving home for the first time for everyone, and also not having any other relationships in an unfamiliar place, kind of like brings everyone pretty close together.
And you have to lean on each other, I guess, as well, because you got, you know, people yelling at you and tasks that you got to do that you don't necessarily know how to do.
Yeah, exactly. It was a massive culture shock, and we all kind of were all in the same sinking boat together, I guess, and had to pull together to kind of make things work.
Now, what year was that?
2004.
So the deployments to Afghanistan, there had been deployments to Afghanistan, but not to the scale of, as to what it was going to be in 2005, 2006. So do you remember when it became apparent to you that you were probably going to get a run?
Probably not until about 2007. So no one really knew what Afghanistan was going to look like in around 2004. It did progressively get busier and busier. There were like some deployments that kept stepping up for the engineers who had trades under their belt, working with SOTG, building the SO compounds. And as we all know, it grew bigger and bigger. And then by about 2008, all the engineers were getting told it's going to be a busy like next decade for us.
Yeah. Now, how did your training change when you knew that you were actually going to be out there sort of applying your skills into the field? Just to give a bit of background, you were going to be doing bomb disposal?
Not initially.
What was the job going to be?
So initially it was search. So we were the guys doing the high-risk search of the like explosives, whether they were cached or whether they were like already implanted to detonate. And to be honest, that was like, I don't know how people justify that. That was like a worthwhile task. It was really dangerous for a lot of guys.
Yeah.
And I don't know how often I would just see like close calls, shake my head and just go, this is a crazy job to be doing and continue to wanting to do it.
Yeah.
Some of the guys out there got some pretty big balls and at the moment, like, They're still the same guys. They haven't sort of changed since those encounters, and I wish those guys all the best.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about you did two tours of Afghanistan. Tell me about your experiences with you did both of them with the mentoring task force. Is that right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. So tell me about what that was like.
So Afghanistan was relatively quiet up until like the first MTF. There was it was dangerous, don't get me wrong, but it was starting to develop and kind of adopt into a bit more of a fighting sort of fighting environment. A lot more IEDs were getting found, a lot more close calls were happening, and a few guys started to get severely injured.
Just to give a little bit of background, so the mentoring task force, those were Australian soldiers who were sent over there to upskill the Afghan military, and the idea was that they were going to eventually take over the work that the Australians were doing. It wasn't really Australian infantrymen; it was more special forces operators that were doing that offensive work in Uruzgan. And so, what would exactly be your role with the mentoring task force? What were the engineers doing?
Yeah, correct. So essentially we all wanted to train ourselves out of our jobs. Mm. We didn't want to be there for the next 10 years because the country didn't belong to us. We just wanted everyone to be able to defend themselves, and that's what we wanted to train the guys to be able to do eventually. And that's what we began doing. However, to be able to do that, it involved us fighting beside the Afghani army. There was a lot of massive cultural differences, a lot of challenges in that regard, not just like language barrier, but also sort of like morals. And that's probably a lot of where a lot of friction comes from the guys that are maybe struggling over once they got back as well, is how a lot of like the cultural differences between the Afghan National Army and the Australian forces. However, just like everywhere, there were some really great dudes, in the Afghani army and also some terrible ones.
The moral differences that you were talking about, it must have been, you know, we won't sort of get into what those things are, but, it's sort of well known what those things are. But going into a place where they are in their country, then you almost have to take on their moral standard. You can't take on their moral standard, but you have to accept that moral standard of them. So that must have been really difficult for everybody.
Yeah. I don't have the tools to deal with that. I don't know how I have dealt with it. We've kind of just moved on. It wasn't really discussed or approached at all.
Yeah.
And you either dealt with it or you struggled. And I know that people are still struggling. I got no advice on what I did or what I did would help other people.
Yeah. Now, after you did your two Afghan tours, you became part of a unit that was called SOA. Was it the Incident Response Regiment then, or was it SOA?
No, that just changed a couple of years before I got that. But yeah, it was Incident Response Regiment, and then changed over to Special Operation Engineer Regiment while I was there.
Now that's a regiment that's part of the Special Forces Group of Australia's Special Operations Command. It's probably the regiment that's least best understood of the Special Forces units that Australia has, but it's also one of the best respected here in Australia and overseas. It's a capability that, you know, Americans and Brits always talk about SOA and sort of how good they are. So can you just give us a quick rundown of how you ended up part of SOA, what the selection process is, and then a little bit about SOA itself?
I feel what I wanted to achieve when I first joined the Army was what SOA was doing. I've always been quite risk-accepting, and once I got good at my job within the regular Army, I wanted to probably challenge myself a bit more and accept a lot more risk and do things that I found a lot more exciting and more adventurous.
Was part of it because you'd been to Afghanistan, you'd seen the guys do it?
Yeah. But also at that time, Afghanistan was winding down.
Yeah.
And I wasn't particularly interested in promotion, but I was really interested in skill development. Mm. And that's a big thing that SOA was able to provide. And while I was, after getting down to SOA and going through their barrier tests and their selections and then their reinforcement, like specialty courses, I felt like an incredibly like better soldier, more mature, more like emotionally intelligent. I felt like a better leader without doing the promotion courses.
What is their barrier test? Is it similar to the 2CDO barrier test?
No. I would say like the fitness, there's a fitness barrier. However, the overarching, I suppose, selection management still goes down to the Army as a whole rather than the individual unit. So guys that when I went down there, guys that went through the barrier test would get prioritised, and then depending on their career path may or may not go down, rather than having the choice to go down like solely between the individual and between the unit.
Yeah, right. And so when you finished your reinforcement cycle, you were sort of in a unique position because Afghanistan was winding down. What was the thing that was on the horizon? What was the deployment that you saw in your mind? What did you think you were going to be doing?
So ISIS was fairly formidable at that stage. And again, nobody thought that ISIS was going to go anywhere anytime soon. But still the deployments weren't really like clear about what sort of fighting that we were going to, or how we were going to be operating in that environment.
So you thought it was a possibility that after Afghanistan, you're like, oh, this might actually be the next thing that we do.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
Like we could have been fighting there for 10 years, just like in Afghanistan. However, when I eventually deployed there in 2016, just after my reinforcement cycle.
So it was just afterwards?
Yeah. So literally went, did reinforcement cycle, went to, worked in Perth for a little while.
Yeah.
Went to the Philippines for a month, came back to Sydney, and then within a couple of weeks doing cultural and pre-deployment training, and then into Iraq.
Now, how did this happen? I mean, you know, this is a plum job for somebody who's in SAR. We're going to talk a little bit about what the work was that you were actually doing. But as a newbie...
I was frothing pretty hard, to be honest.
Oh, I can imagine. How did they? So, how did it end up being you?
I don't know. A little bit of luck, a little bit of, like, reputation.
Yeah.
Steady
hand. You'd had a couple of Afghan deployments.
Yeah. Like not saying that, like, there was a few other guys that could have done it just the same as me. But then... they were probably like needed. They had other skill sets that were like more important in Baghdad, where I was able to just operate by myself with the two commando guys and as the only engineer on the ground.
Yeah, right. So give us the blow by blow. So what we're going to be talking about was the Battle of Mosul, which ended up being pretty much the most significant urban battle since Vietnam. It was an epic battle, which I wrote a book about. Called Mosul, Australia's Secret War Inside the ISIS Caliphate. So can you just give us a blow-by-blow from when you were sort of chosen for that job and how you ended up in Bartella, which is the place where the Australians were?
Well, I was asked, like, do you want to go to Baghdad? Do you want to stay in Baghdad or do you want to go to Mosul? I had no idea what was happening in Mosul.
Yeah, right. So what was the job in Baghdad? What were you going to be doing there?
So that was a mentoring force.
Yeah, right. Taji.
Yeah. So guys... Oh, yeah. Not Taji, sorry, in Baghdad.
Right.
And it was, like, heavily instructional. You know, you'd teach guys counter IED techniques and, you know, dealing with IEDs, but also a bit of search here and there.
Yeah.
Which is cool, but after I was told about the option in Mosul, I was like, well, what's happening in Mosul?
You didn't know that the city was completely occupied by ISIS?
I had no idea at that stage because I've been in Philippines for the last months, right? My boss was like, oh, you know, at the moment they've got this mansion there that's, you know, been rocketed and bombed out. The whole village is, like, pretty much rubble.
Yeah.
And security is pretty loose up there. But that's where they're going to be, like, dealing with a lot of the ISIS conflicts. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Like, I'm not scared. I don't mind a bit of risk here and there.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was pretty much the conversation.
So let's just figure out where you were. So the house in Bartella had been seized, and then there was a strike cell that was set up. I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks afterwards, maybe a little bit after that. Did you come shortly after that or did you come pretty much straight away after the house was seized?
No, so the boys before us, so the deployment that we were handed over to us, they adopted and they got into Mosul before us.
Yeah.
They inherited the Bartella sort of like suburb.
Yeah.
Did a lot of cleaning up themselves, established like security and sort of like some sort of game plan for the future and set the scene for our deployment where we're able to, like, yeah, crush ISIS.
So tell me about your experiences. Presumably you flew into Erbil?
Yes. Yeah.
And then you overlanded from Erbil to Mosul?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your drive from Erbil to Mosul, just watching it go from, you know, a relatively normal-looking place to just Hades?
Yeah, so... it felt really sketchy, being a new guy, and, you know, hanging out with a whole lot of dudes that had some really intense Afghan experience. I was just under the presumption that this was a regular sort of like deal and environment. After talking to a few of the guys, everyone felt it was sketchy. We got to Erbil, sorted out our own, like, personal stores and then did some sketchy handover, met some other, like, random people, and it was just this whole logistical thing that felt impromptu and...
Improvised. Yeah.
And it was cool. Like, I found it exciting.
Yeah, it's real special forces stuff, right?
And then we got into this bus that was, like, super dodgy, like, shitty curtains, bells and just, like... all these weird things hanging up on the windows and just jingling around.
Yeah, just a civilian bus.
Yeah. Wrecked like suspension, and there was probably about six of us. Believe we weren't like wearing anything like military at that stage. We just had our, you know, had our guns on us, and we had no real like concept about where we were driving or what we were like getting into.
Was this were these Americans who were looking after you then, or
not at that stage? I think we had a local contractor that was driving us.
Yeah.
So I don't even think we had like comms at that stage, but like I think we had like maybe a couple of shady mobile phones with shady reception.
Yeah.
But we were driving along dirt roads, somewhere. Yeah. And we just had to have faith that the guy that was driving, this local contractor that was driving,
gonna take you where you should,
was gonna like hold up his end of the deal. And after about an hour, we ended up meeting up with some American guys that we didn't know either, but yeah, we kind of knew that things were ticking over properly.
Yeah, and then presumably they had, an APC or a tank or whatever it was, and then drove you into Bartella.
Correct. Yeah.
Was it when you got to Bartella that you got a sense of just what was going on and how big the scope of the battle was?
Yeah, it was like very interesting. Like it was like surreal. You know, all the photos that you see about just demolished suburb upon suburb upon suburb, kind of just, and it was actually like a little bit. It was just like a little bit, I don't know, disappointing.
Eerie?
Yeah, eerie, but kind of like disappointing that a whole civilization just could be like wiped out within a few months, right? But, you know, that's war, I guess.
Well, did it motivate you? Because, you know, the job was basically to eradicate ISIS. This was the territorial battle against ISIS. There was a fight in Raqqa later on, but Mosul was really where it happened.
Yeah, exactly. I think all the plans, or even just the structure of how we were going to operate there, was still kind of being ironed out.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it just evolved into this thing where we ended up beating ISIS towards the end of the six-month deployment. I'm not sure if that was the plan from the start. I know that we weren't meant to be like engaging with any ISIS ourselves, but we're trying to have the biggest effect just back from the front line as possible.
Now, tell me a little bit about your role, because my understanding of what was happening in Bartella is that the two CDO guys forward projected into this house, and they basically were cordoning the area with this Iraqi CTS, the counterterrorism service, and there was a Navy SEAL element there as well. And they had set up a strike cell. So the strike cell was basically, it was almost like a conductor in the orchestra where all the planes that were coming in, the drones and things like that. So, there was this sort of real momentum to try and keep these strikes going so the CTS could project into the city and sort of defeat ISIS. But as a SOAR operator, what was your role there?
Within the strike cell or within Mosul?
Within the strike cell and within Bartella.
To be honest, I didn't have much of like a job within the strike cell. That was all mainly for the JTAC guys. However, I was able to sort of like provide advice on IED laying TTPs like tactics and kind of identify. Yeah.
When the CTS found something.
Yeah, or even when we had surveillance on an IED being laid at the time by ISIS.
Yep.
I was able to provide that.
That informational piece.
That expert opinion and kind of explain why I thought that and why I thought that in the middle of the road that they were digging in a pressure plate and why there was going to be other explosives in other walls and whatever played on for the next 2 minutes. And then that way, and then they were able to use on occasions that information as like a targeting response.
The initial role for the incident response regiment, or one of the initial roles, and you know this ended up becoming the task for SOAR as well, was counter chemical, biological, and nuclear threat. And two of those things were encountered in Mosul. Did you have any interaction with the nuclear threat and the chemical threat that ISIS posed to the soldiers there?
Well, this was supposed to be my primary skill set that I was able to provide the guys in Mosul. The chem bio stuff was my bag, where I could at least provide some sort of mitigation against that threat towards our team.
Had there already been a chemical attack?
Not to my knowledge. There was definitely like a lot of intelligence that they had the knowledge, two, like the materials, and three, the intent.
Mm.
So it was kind of just an impending sort of expectation.
Yeah.
And eventually it did happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, my primary task up there was to provide decon, but also advice on whether
decon being decontamination.
Yeah. So if there was an attack, we could relatively sort of clean everyone up and provide like some good first aid as quickly as possible.
So tell me about what happened when the chemical attack did come. It wasn't, you know, the trenches of World War One, but it was a chemical attack.
So we're always concerned about this, the chemical mustard. We knew that they were manufacturing a lot of the stuff. However, the purity was never really fantastic. And when there were sort of attacks, a lot of the mustard compound itself was being degraded by either the explosion or even just like going off, just due to like whatever exposure, like the oxygen exposure. So that was kind of like a relief that they weren't able to manufacture military grade mustard. But how eventually, like there was an attack towards maybe like the third, fourth month of my deployment, and it was actually like a real surprise. We were anticipating it, but we didn't want to cause mass hysteria and provide sort of information that was going to
excite ISIS, right?
Or even kick up a whole lot of other like pending mitigations, like everyone adopting
having to wear masks, mop suits and stuff.
Yeah, masks when it wasn't necessary. So it was quite a deliberate sort of assessment. It was about like 10 p.m. when we did we got a few casualties that were presenting with the signs and symptoms of mustard. They had redness of the eyes, they had sore throats, they complained about the stories and the encounters that they had with a black liquid falling them on their clothes and like exploding near them. Was you know consistent with what a mustard attack would look like. However, that was about the 12th hour, and no one was really like showing signs of blisters.
Yeah,
what you'd you know see in you know the photos from Vietnam.
Hmm.
So after kind of expecting worst case, went through this whole decon. Made sure that everyone was like washed down thoroughly and provided new clothes and got them through to the medical emergency clinic where they were like monitored for the next like 12 hours, and within another like further 12 hours they were the guys that had itchy eyes and like and burning skin were complaining like presented with
blisters
with blisters all over them. The unusual thing about that was everyone that had exposure to the mustard, the most painful thing for them were was the burning of their eyes and the burning of their throats.
Mm.
The blisters weren't presenting like giving them any pain at all.
Yeah, right. Interesting.
It was interesting.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I can imagine that, you know, when there's an attack like this and, you know, this was at the point where ISIS had been encircled and, you know, there'd been this sort of, you know, constriction. So, you know, they were in a position where it looked like they were going to lose this battle. So that sounds like desperation. And I can imagine for you guys and for the planners that that would have said to them, you know, we have to finish this thing because otherwise they're going to get more desperate and they might actually figure this out?
Well, what actually happened was the Battle of Old Mosul.
Hmm.
You've heard that story. So that ended up being like a massive siege, like hundreds of people basically kidnapped and made hostage within Old Mosul, which is a highly built up CBD, where alleyways won't even provide access for vehicles, like for kilometres.
Yeah.
And that was their last strike. That was their last sort of act of desperation that they had on the board until we were able to, and the CTS were able to go through and systematically go through each building. Yeah, and, you know, it was a mess for those guys, as you can imagine. But it was necessary. Like, it was the only thing that you could do short of locking everyone down and people starving to death.
Yeah, and, you know, finally they destroyed the Al-Nuri Mosque, which is, you know, a great place of antiquity, and it was also the place where al-Baghdadi, where he nominated the Islamic State as a caliphate.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
We sort of spoke a little bit about the possibility of there had been of there being a radiological weapon. If you can talk about it, be great if you could. I don't know whether that was within your remit. I don't know whether that was when you were there. But that was that was why it was so important to capture Mosul University. Were you part of any of that?
I don't know what I can say about that.
Yeah, fair enough. If you feel like maybe you can't talk about it, we won't talk about it. Hey, you can read about it in my book. Well, let's talk a little bit about the other things that you did. One of the things that I heard about that a couple of people told me about was next door to the house in Bartella, and this might have happened before you got there. There was a field next door, and the field had been cleared, or it was a clearing space, and that's where guys were doing their ablutions. But somebody did step on an IED. It was supposedly a bag that had already sort of started to wilt into the soil, so the explosion wasn't that bad. But were you there when that happened?
Yeah, so that wasn't in Bartella. That was on like the other side of the Tigris,
right?
And there was a lack of intel with this whole area. As the whole Mosul battle evolved, we moved from one side of the river about halfway throughout the deployment onto the other side of the river, and where we ended up on the second on the other side of the river was another massive like mansion compound, which
was that TAA Wyvern?
Yeah, yep. Which there was no previous history on, but as we kind of like continued to live there, more questions got asked, and it turned out that it belonged to an executioner.
Yeah, right.
And as we talked to more and more people throughout the deployment, more information came through, and this sort of compound was being used by ISIS and an executioner, and was like actually heavily guarded.
Right.
Some of the the tools that we're using to guard this compound were like IEDs around the fence line. These particular IEDs were running like perpendicular for about 20 meters, perpendicular to the compound wall.
Hmm.
And we like nobody had any idea that they were there, including myself. And the way we did find them, or the way we did eventually come across them, was that when we were building a car park outside of the compound, a bulldozer drove over and initiated an explosive. Gratefully, like it deflagrated, which means it partially exploded.
Yeah,
And that was due to like just weathering of the homemade explosives. But that obviously triggered some more searching of the area. And we ended up finding like six other IEDs.
Yeah.
Lit along that wall.
So did you bring in? Did they bring in a team to support you, or did you have to do this individually with guys that you had upskilled?
Yeah. So I found this one indication of some explosive and sought assistance from one of the SEAL doggies. So the SEAL doggy was able to cast his dog over the explosive and give a secondary indication that there was something, like there was some explosive there.
Yeah.
And then one of the SEAL EOD team guys went over and had a search himself and ended up pulling out like this 155, which is a massive bomb that gets shot out of a cannon.
Mm. You were talking about the SEAL doggy and the SEAL EOD. There was an Australian Special Forces element, and then there was also a US Navy SEAL element. Did you have much interaction with those guys?
Yeah, we were living side by side. We had our tents and they had their tents, but they were basically like just across the path.
Did you do much work with them?
No, like our relation, like we had separate sort of teams that we were mentoring. So we had the CTS and they had another team, I can't remember, or maybe they had just another element of CTS, I can't remember.
Yeah.
But our two forces didn't work side by side.
Right. You did say earlier, and if you can't talk about this, that's fine, and you know I can cut it out as well, that you worked a little bit with the French. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happens, how an Australian in the Battle of Mosul ends up working with the French?
Yeah, so that was I actually had a good relationship with the French. There's a massive history between the Americans and the French not getting along.
Yeah.
But personally, I was able to extend my hand out and kind of offer them help with.
How did that happen though? Did they turn up to the house or to Wyvern and say, you know, hey, we're doing some work, we need some help?
No, I just basically said, sup, like, how you doing?
Yeah.
And one of them one of them could speak poor English.
Where was this? Where did you meet this guy?
In Bartella.
Yeah, it was in Bartella.
Yeah. So they already had a house set up.
Yeah.
Down the road from us, and I was happy to be able to sort of like extend my skill set to another country. I didn't realise how much friction there was between America and France.
Yeah.
It was an interesting dynamic, and towards the end I was like, when they needed help or they wanted to ask for a capability, the Americans were like less reluctant to help them than they were at the start.
Yeah. The French were doing something that was a little bit different to what everybody else was doing. There was a lot of coalition support for the Iraqis who were clearing the city, and that's what the Five Eyes guys were doing. That's what the Brits, the Australians, the Americans were doing, and that was the Australian mission. So the point of the gunfighters, the Australian gunfighters there, were not to get in gunfights and not to have any casualties. But the French were on a slightly different mission. Can you talk a little bit about that, or?
Yeah, like we're familiar with what's that comic called?
Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah, so we're all familiar that there was like a big sort of ISIS radicalization problem within France. And France sort of decided to clear that up themselves, and they had a lot of individuals that they were identifying and surveilling from France, and then chasing overseas to Iraq and Syria.
So their job was basically to, during the Battle of Mosul, find French jihadis who eventually could matriculate back to France and, you know, commit another atrocity. And they had these French special forces teams just to make sure that was never going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. They had very, like, autonomous sort of tactics and strategies. I'm a little bit jealous that they had that sort of like freedom on the battlefield.
Yeah.
But everything that they did was, you know, like above board and still like achieving a lot for their own government. Just unfortunate that they weren't a part of the
greater strategy,
the official war against ISIS.
Yeah. The Battle of Mosul finishes and it was a success. It was. You know, there were elements of that battle that probably it'd be preferable if it didn't go that way. You know, there was a lot of places that was destroyed. You know, that's just the way that ISIS chose to fight. There were a lot of civilians killed as well, which is also the way that ISIS chose to fight. But you must have got a sense of satisfaction knowing that the job was actually done. It was a job that had to be done.
Oh, massively. It was hard to imagine that it was done. It had been ISIS had a massive foothold in Iraq and Syria for the last 5 years.
Mm.
And then within a six-month deployment, it was like just disappeared.
Yeah.
Obviously, awesome results. But, yeah, hard to believe. Like, coming from Afghanistan, it was a slow, meticulous, battle. Every 6 months, it was you weren't sure that it was going to end. And still, it's, you know, there's things happening in Afghanistan still.
Yeah.
But, yeah, within 6 months, we were confident that we broke ISIS's back, and then that was just continued to be confirmed over the next 6 to 12 months.
Personally, though, like you were saying, that, you know, you were frothing when you got this opportunity to go to Mosul. When you came back to Australia, you must have recognised that this was going to be a career peak for you, and that must have presented its own set of issues.
It was. So, well, I came back, I had a month off, went on holidays for a month, rested, and then within 2 weeks, I was back over there for another 6 weeks.
Oh, right. What was that?
So that was that confirmation that ISIS had really withdrawn. So I think that was the end of the Battle of Old Mosul.
Right.
So that was still happening and continuing on while we pulled out. And after my holiday, it was good to go back there.
Just make sure.
Yeah, reconnect with relationships with other French forces that I met over there, other CTS and Iraqi army guys, and also other Americans that were still there. And I was only there for another 6 weeks. However, within a month of being there, it was definitely a completely different war to what I was there, to when I was there.
Because there was an element of Australians who went on to the Battle of Talifar, is that right?
Yes. I don't know too much about that. Yeah. But, yeah.
The thing that I'm getting at, though, is that, there's something that you've been training for your entire life, and you basically get what you want, and now you come back and, as an identity, as somebody who sees himself as an EOD and a bomb tech and all that sort of stuff, you've reached the zenith, you've gone to the Olympics, and so there must have been a bit of a letdown afterwards.
I knew that was a peak, but I feel I was in the army for 16 years, and every few years there was another peak.
Yeah.
So I was hopeful there was going to be another peak post to that. Who knows? Again, we couldn't be sure that was going to be definitely the end of ISIS. There was always going to be new tasks and new exciting things around the corner with, the environment that we were working in. But I definitely did not feel
that was
the best of me was finished.
So you're transitioning out of the army now, or you have left the army. Tell us a little bit about your decision-making and why and when you decided to leave the army.
I didn't do too long within the special operations community. I only did about 4 or 5 years. But towards that end of 4 or 5 years, I was cooked. I was generally unwell.
Did you feel like you were mentally unwell or physically unwell with the tempo?
I was mentally unwell, not to the point of, self-harm.
Yeah.
But I knew that my health, my general health was degrading because I stopped enjoying PT. I wasn't looking after my nutrition. I didn't feel happy. Relationships were exhausting. Mm. And so then I just knew that this wasn't a life that needed, this wasn't a job that needed to be continued if it was going to, make me feel unwell or if the aim of like my life is just to be happy, like I should,
this
should
isn't it.
Pick something new, yeah.
So tell me about why you think you started to feel like that.
Fatigue, definitely. Fatigue and isolation. I don't know whether isolation was something that I chose or whether it was just a lifestyle of Sydney. But regardless, I would go home in the afternoons and just feel like terrible. Like by myself in this big house that I had, and there was no reason for me, like looking at my own life, I felt like there was no reason why I should be like feeling bad about it because I felt like I had everything. It was just I can't even put my finger on it. It was just a dissatisfaction with probably the direction that it was going.
Do you think maybe you felt in isolation because you were, you know, within this sort of secretive part of the military that it sort of had been drilled into you not to talk about the things that you were doing, not to share widely what was happening to you?
I think it was a military lifestyle, being unpredictable, busy, constantly traveling. It's very hard to sort of develop hobbies or anything outside of work when you can't commit to anything.
Yeah, it's like, can you be part of this football team? Yes, okay, if I'm not fighting ISIS in Iraq.
Yeah, I'll do it this weekend.
Yeah,
I can't say that I'm going to do it next weekend or even in 4 weeks' time.
Yeah,
and you know, I loved combat sports myself, and I've never been able to train consistently to end up getting it like a fight in, and that's kind of like a regret, right? Like, and that's something that kind of haunts you.
Yeah.
Couldn't even have like pot plants.
Yeah.
Like.
So when you did actually make the decision, was it really tough for you to get there? Or once you realized that, you know, that you weren't maximizing your life with this job anymore, you realized that you had to do something else?
Yeah. Probably came down to actually some really good advice that I got. So I did a special operations bomb disposal course, and some of the advice and critiquing or points that were passed on to me after a couple of tasks was that I needed to improve my like course of action development. So when you get incredibly stressed or drawn in by like smothered by pressure, it's very easy to just continue to push forward instead of taking a step back, taking in more information and trying to problem solve.
Yeah.
And I took that literally with my life.
Hmm.
If my end goal was to like be happy and sort of have like maybe a family in the future, what I was doing with the military career was what I was doing during these tasks. I was just pushing forward, kind of like expecting the outcome to eventually come through persistence.
Yeah.
So I took that advice and I changed directions. I took a step back, left the military. Well, first I decided that what I wanted to do, and then kind of developed a plan for that, and then took long service leave and left.
Tell us about your decision making and how you realized what you wanted to do.
Through just my own like personal development and using Google and YouTube and just watching, you know, educational videos or even opinions by just random people that I found interesting. I kind of learnt that my personality and who I am, like through my virtues and my characteristics, are quite caring for people, and I'm quite interested in helping people, and I found that kind of using my background within special operations and operating under pressure would be quite helpful within psychology and also like more specifically sports psychology.
And so that's what you're doing now. You're studying psychology with a view to getting a business degree also.
Correct, yeah. Even during the transition period with Defence, which was actually like one of the best things I've done, the amount of support that like Defence or Army gives out for members like transitioning out of the Army, I found like incredible. There was packages there available that help you build your CV, help you build like determine like what jobs are suitable for your personality, but also like interviewing techniques. And through that discovery, confirmed that psychology was a good idea, and then also starting to talk and with people about psychology that were in defense. At the moment, I know like four people that I used to work with that are going to study psychology. So it's a common field for us, and leaning on people, like information's obviously key, and being able to have a support network that's so readily available to share information that they've learned, yeah, it's been a massive like help towards me getting out.
Now, transitioning from the military is tough regardless of who you are. But coming from a special forces background, because the identity is so built around your job, and there is a sort of an unusual way of manifesting your personality when you're in that type of job, it's really hard to go into a civilian lifestyle. You know, one of the reasons is because everything becomes a little bit boring. But how did you manage that transition? And is this something that you sort of you methodically did? You realized that this was going to be difficult, and you built up strategies around that?
Throughout the last like 10, 15 years, quite a few friends have left the military, and I've seen a few friends like do really well and move forward with their lives.
Yeah.
And a few friends that have kind of held on to being a military soldier as a person, instead of really focusing on just being a good person. And the individuals that seem to focus on striving forward, and you can still be proud of like your service, but moving forward away from defense and away from army and developing new skills that can be useful in the civilian sector.
So you can't
appear to be the happiest.
You need a different identity, is essentially what you're saying. You know, like wearing camo, the patches, all that sort of stuff is maybe sometimes counterintuitive to this transition that you have to make. You have to identify yourself either as a dad or, you know, in another role or something like that. That's healthy.
Yeah, like just because guys aren't wearing the uniform anymore doesn't mean that they can't, like, they're not being proud of who they were.
Yeah.
I've never really identified myself throughout my army career as a soldier first. I'd like to think that I'm a good person first, and that's how I want to continue my life. Unfortunately, through like instinctual obedience, guys are getting drummed into themselves that this is their personality now. They're being issued like a personality, and unfortunately, they can't pull away from that. I don't know how to
help them,
but hopefully through that psych degree, I can kind of give some sort of advice in the future.
The last thing I did want to ask you about was Anzac Day. And, we talked about this previously, about you being able to transition not only your career but also your identity to a certain extent. And that is not saying that you're not proud of your service and you're not a soldier. It's just that you have priorities. Other priorities now that you've transitioned out of defence. But what does Anzac Day mean to you?
I believe it's a day to remember guys from World War I and World War II.
So you don't think it's marking the modern wars?
I do, but I think it's over. Like, I feel like it's marketed. Like, I would like to see people, like, less there to remember, like, themselves or what they've achieved throughout, like, Afghanistan or Iraq, but be a bit more selfless and remember the guys, like, hundreds of guys, thousands of guys dying in a lot more terrible conditions than what we went through. Sure, there'll be a day where, our service will be highly regarded, but selfishly, I think I want to remember those guys, like in World War I and World War II.
Beautiful, mate. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks, mate.
That was Sweebs. Really interesting guy. Really interesting story. If you want to know more about the Battle of Mosul, well, obviously, if you want to know more about the Battle of Mosul, then you should buy my book, which is Mosul by Ben McKelvey, Australia's Secret War Inside the ISIS Caliphate. But if you want to hear more about this conflict, that was Sweebs. Interesting guy, really interesting story. If you want to know more about the Battle of Mosul, well, obviously you should pick up my book, Mosul, Australia's Secret War Inside the ISIS Caliphate by Ben McKelvey. But if you want to hear more about the battle, I would recommend the new podcast, The Line. You can search it on iTunes. It's an Apple original. I'm in no way associated. Acast is in no way associated as far as I know, but I've been listening to it and I've been finding it fascinating. Anyway, before I shuffle off for a little while, I just wanted to say thank you also for listening to the show. I really appreciate your interest. I really appreciate your time and your downloads. And we will meet again. But until then, follow your bliss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.